It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In his State of the Union address last night, President Trump directly mentioned Pennsylvania twice, but his calls for legislation have much further reaching effects. We're going to explore the president's remarks about what he calls the Great American Comeback and how that is or is not happening in our state. Laura Olson covers politics and federal policy for The Morning Call and joins us on the line from Washington. Laura, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And in studio is WESA's government accountability editor, Chris Potter. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Kevin. Good morning, Laura.
Let's start with a quick reflection overall on the address. Laura, let's start with you.
Well, there was a lot of pageantry, as we usually see in these speeches, and the president really relishes when he gets to be that showman. We saw him go from telling a fourth grader from Philadelphia that she was going to get this long-awaited scholarship to go attend a better-performing school, to handing out a medal, to surprising a military wife whose husband has been deployed. So there was a lot of the pageantry, there was almost kind of a game show-esque quality to it at some points. And then the Republican lawmakers were pretty eager to cheer him along. We heard some four more years chants in the chamber last night. And then we saw some pageantry on the other side as well at the end of the speech, summing up what the Democrats thought when House Speaker Nancy Pelosi ripped up her copy of the speech before she exited the chamber. So,
Chris?
That kind of sets the tone for this reelection year here.
Yeah, I think that's true. I was waiting for him to sort of say, hey, everybody, there's two golden tickets taped to the bottom of your seats. Everybody get up and see if you're the lucky winner or whatever. I would say two things that were notable about the speech. One is that it sort of mixed these sorts of appeals to African-American voters in particular. Look at my opportunity zones. Look at what I've done on criminal justice reform. At the same time, there was a lot of appeals to the base on issues like abortion, giving Rush Limbaugh a Presidential Medal of Freedom right in the room, all that kind of stuff. And I think we also need to be saying that the president told some whoppers last night, the biggest of one being that his administration is out there to protect people with pre-existing medical conditions. Healthcare is going to be a big issue. And this is a president whose Justice Department is actively involved in litigation to overturn the Affordable Care Act, which includes those protections. So a lot of the pageantry, but then also sometimes where I think he just simply wasn't being honest with people.
Trump started by saying the economy has never been better in the history of the U.S., saying wages are rising the fastest, 16% for low-income workers. How much of that is due to administration policies compared to 21 states alone this year taking action to raise their minimum wages? Not Pennsylvania, however. Laura?
One of the things that we've heard economists talk a lot about is the wages aren't rising as fast as they think that they should be at this point. That we have seen some job gains, and one thing in particular we've looked at that he's talked a lot about are the manufacturing jobs, because we, especially in Pennsylvania, we hear him talk over and over again about those manufacturing jobs and how they've risen during his administration. It depends when you're looking at that time period. If you look at the early part of the administration, the manufacturing jobs were going up. But then if you look at the more recent part of his administration, those jobs have taken a hit. So Pennsylvania is just barely ahead when you're looking at manufacturing jobs, but not as far ahead as you'd think that we were by just listening to what the president has to say on those.
And Chris, 5,700 manufacturing jobs lost last year in Pennsylvania. That's according to state officials, Department of Labor and Industry.
Yeah, and mining hasn't been doing all that well. That was another key kind of blue-collar constituency that the president spent a lot of time when he first ran for election in 2016 talking about. I mean, I think we should be fair here. I mean, there are bigger global macroeconomic trends that are driving some of this. Automation, specifically in manufacturing, is a big deal. And then just, changes in fuel sources, the rise of natural gas. So, you know, I wouldn't necessarily lay that at the feet of the president, but and I wouldn't even necessarily fault the administration for its policies not reversing these broader trends. But, you know, I have an economist friend who says there's no such thing as 3% unemployment. You're either 100% employed or 100% not employed. And I think that's the reality. These gains have been very uneven, and we've seen that here in Western Pennsylvania, where a lot of even steel producers are having a hard time.
The president said during his administration, 7 million people have come off food stamps. State Human Services Secretary Teresa Miller says 90,000 Pennsylvanians will lose, not choose to come off, but he removed from receiving food stamps this spring. The president implied people are better off. But from where you sit, is that the case, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's I don't think it's an either or situation necessarily. I mean, clearly there have been economic gains. Unemployment is low. There's no question about that. You can argue about when that started. It clearly got underway during the Obama administration, but it has persisted into the Trump years. On the other hand, you do have this effort by this administration, consistent with longstanding Republican policy, to remove people from the rolls if they're deemed able-bodied and people think that they should be able to work. So I think there's a combination of factors going on there.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about the State of the Union address with Laura Olson of The Morning Call and WESA's Chris Potter. Trump took a direct shot at Governor Tom Wolf for vetoing a bill to expand public financing to private and religious schools. And he awarded a scholarship to the Philadelphia fourth grader Janiyah Davis that, Laura, you briefly mentioned. School choice has been on his list for a while. What does this signal maybe to educators in Pennsylvania, Laura?
Well, we're going to be hearing directly from his administration in Pennsylvania about that today. Vice President Mike Pence is going to be in Philadelphia talking about school choice. One thing that really struck me from that section of the speech was that it wasn't quite clear what's going on here. He's been a big supporter of school choice, big proponent, there isn't a federal school choice program, and so it wasn't quite clear where the scholarship was coming from that he awarded to this fourth grade girl. We reached out for some more details, but it's a little bit fuzzy on what exactly was going on here. But he did. He took a direct shot at Governor Wolf by name. Governor Wolf did veto a proposal last year that would have expanded the state's current EITC program, the tax credit program for these school choice scholarships. It would have expanded it by $100 million, and he vetoed that. Instead, in the state budget, there was a smaller expansion by $25 million. So he wasn't exactly right on the details there when it came to what we saw unfolding in the state.
Democrats, especially here in Pennsylvania, did well in House races in 2018 on the promise of keeping the Affordable Care Act. But Mr. Trump said he would never let, quote, socialism destroy health care. Chris, do you expect socialism and health care to be major campaign points here in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Democrats have made no secret. They ran very successfully, as you mentioned, on that issue back in 2018. I don't think it's any secret that they'll be doing so again this year. And obviously, the president and Republicans, I mean, we saw the socialism label used against Connor Lamb, for crying out loud. I mean, so this is clearly a label they think has some salience. How well it works is going to depend partly on, you know, who the Democratic nominee is or whatever. But yeah, I mean, these are kind of the opening salvos of this campaign. And you will definitely hear Democrats say, as they did last night, as I heard them doing again this morning, this president doesn't have your back on some of these issues. And the problem for Democrats, of course, is that court action that could overturn the Affordable Care Act won't happen until next year. And one thing that was conspicuously missing in this speech last night is, what are we going to do? What is my plan? Ever since the Republican effort to overturn the Affordable Care Act failed, everybody remembers John McCain doing the thumbs down thing, there has really been very little discussion of what a world looks like post-Affordable Care Act. And that's a big open question, and I expect to hear a lot of talk about it.
Laura,
and that's why Democrats really want to talk about health care, too, because they see an area of opportunity, as Chris noted there, that the administration doesn't have a plan. So it's an area where they can potentially have a little bit of an edge here in an election year and say, well, what are you getting from this guy? Here's our plan on how we're actually going to improve your health care.
Trump credits America's dominance in the oil and gas industry with, quote, bold regulatory reduction campaigns. Pennsylvania feeling the effects of some of those rollbacks. Briefly, Laura, how do you imagine this could play out in the upcoming election?
Well, I think we're going to hear a lot about fracking and natural gas, particularly depending on who the Democratic nominee is, because several of them have talked pretty critically about cracking down on fracking and the drilling that we see, particularly in western Pennsylvania. So that's something that's likely to come up again in the presidential race, an area for Republicans to say, and the president to say, look, this is a booming area where it's important for us to have this energy independence. And look at what the Democrats want to do. They want to shut that down, and it would limit some of the opportunities.
Right, Chris. Briefly, local Democrats are actually playing on this issue as well, at least as fracking is concerned.
Yeah, it's a big divisive issue, but you know, you obviously have Connor Lamb supportive of the industry, having endorsed Joe Biden. As Laura says, a lot depends on who the nominee is. But it's a tough issue. There are obviously a lot of Democrats with environmental concerns, climate change, an issue that barely came up at all last night, even though it represents a civilizational threat to humanity by most accounts, have some real concerns about the release of methane and whether that offsets some of the gains in reducing carbon dioxide from burning coal. Not to mention water and air quality impact. So it's a divisive issue, and I think that's part of why you will hear Republicans talk about it. They've been very good at using these wedge issues to kind of divide the Democratic base against itself.
And some real quick ones. Infrastructure. Pennsylvania has 3,700 structurally deficient bridges. The president talked about infrastructure briefly. This resonates with across parties and across levels of government, Chris.
Yeah, but it's like, are we going to have another infrastructure week again? I mean, it's just like infrastructure is one of those things when Trump first came into office that seemed to be a kind of easy grab for him, a bipartisan thing. Everybody likes infrastructure. It has not really germinated. We'll see if this is any different going forward.
And Laura, access to high-speed internet, the president mentioned, especially in rural areas, a big issue for many of our neighbors, particularly small colleges. Will the feds do more actually to improve that access?
I think I go with Chris. This is a lot like the broader question of infrastructure. It's something that there's a lot of agreement on, but probably not an issue where we're going to see a lot of progress this year with all the distractions.
And one word answers for you to. Trump used the phrase blue collar boom, which he first mentioned in the World Economic Forum last month. Will this be his battle cry in 2020 in Pennsylvania?
Huzzah!
And
yes,
absolutely.
Okay. And will it
get used to hearing that one?
Yeah. All right. Laura Olson covers federal policy and the government for The Morning Call. Chris Potter is WESA's government accountability editor. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. Thank you. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Governor Tom Wolf's latest proposed budget includes a familiar severance tax on Marcellus Shale gas drillers and an increase in minimum wage. We'll take a look at the numbers and hear reaction from House Majority Leader Brian Cutler. And later, a local production is keeping alive the legacy of author, TV personality, and raconteur Quentin Crisp. What conversations would you like to hear on The Confluence? Send us your suggestions to confluence@wesa.fm. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, lawyer and LGBT rights activist Evan Wolfson is born in 1957. Wolfson attended Taylor Alderdice High School before going to Yale and Harvard. He wrote his thesis on same-sex marriage long before the topic was in the general conversation. For years, he worked for the gay rights advocacy nonprofit Lambda Legal Defense and Education Fund and coordinated the groups that helped get same-sex marriage passed. He appeared before the United States Supreme Court to advocate for equal rights and wrote the book Why Marriage Matters: America, Equality, and Gay People's Rights to Marry. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
When Hollywood comes to Pittsburgh, it can provide a financial boost to some local businesses. With a Pittsburgh Business Report on 90.5 WESA, I'm Maria Scapoletto. Andy Winsko has been serving up food on local movie sets for about 7 years now. He owns the barbecue business Pittsburgh Smokehouse. He says when movies shoot on location locally, he reaps some of the benefits.
When they're filming, you know, steadily, I'm probably good 20%, I'd say, of my business right now is a movie in the TV industry. Probably it could be anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000 a month, possibly.
The movie Sweet Girl's been filming in Pittsburgh now for a few months. That's starring Jason Momoa. How busy have you been providing food for that specific production?
Oh, I've been extremely busy with that. They have a big crew. They've had a lot of background people, and they need extra food. Tuesday, I believe it was, I went down to the Carnegie Museum and delivered a bacon bar. Smoked bacon, lettuce and tomato and mac and cheese, and it's people just come running. When you open up the lids, they smell the bacon. I feel like the Pied Piper, of bacon.
Is it different preparing and serving food for cast and crew on a movie set as compared to any other catering job that you have?
Well, you always try to make sure it's, you know, 100% spot on, no matter whether it's for the industry or the food truck or catering. You have to give them a quality product.
What are the hours like catering for a movie production as opposed to maybe a graduation party?
The movies, it's very demanding. I could deliver food at noon, 5 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 3 in the morning, which I've done many times, you know, on set, on location, where they, you know, they might start filming at, say, 7 o'clock at night, and they need, and they go until 7 o'clock the next morning. They need, you know, some supplemental food around 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. And I look forward to it.
So flexibility is key in this industry.
You have to be very flexible. When you when someone tells you, hey, we need the food at 8 o'clock at night, they tell that to you the day before. Then the next morning, they say, hey, we need the food at 9 o'clock. Then they say, they call you back an hour later, say, oh, now we need it for 6 o'clock. So you have to be very flexible. That's industry, where they do things. Constant change.
And do you charge a rate that's a consistent rate, whether it's a movie set or whether it's another job?
Oh, it's, you know, it's equal. I don't charge anybody more or anybody less.
Have you picked up business from folks on a movie set saying, I really like your barbecue. Can you cater a tailgate party I'm having soon?
Oh, extreme amounts. You know, it's fascinating. I get a phone call and, you know, I know the face, but I don't know the name. They say, hey, this is so-and-so. I met you on set. I said, yeah, sure. Like the girl who runs the Pittsburgh Film Office, I've catered for her and countless others. It just makes me feel so good that they love my food.
What's the next job that's been lined up for you to provide food for an upcoming movie or TV show?
Well, we're finishing up Sweet Girl. Well, no, I think they stopped filming in a couple weeks. But there's a series coming out on Showtime called Rust. Matter of fact, yesterday I just delivered some food to the production office, for the crew, for 30 people. But the people that I know, they're getting prepared to, start that one up end of March. I believe they start filming.
So you're just keeping busy and Hollywood's helping out.
Oh, definitely. It's great. Yeah, if it go away, I'd be the saddest guy in the world.
On the eve of Sunday's Oscars, Winsco will be providing food for the Pittsburgh Film Office's annual fundraising gala downtown. In business headlines, since the closure last year of the Hill District Shop and Save, residents have been cut off from easy access to fresh food. But the Greater Pittsburgh Community Food Bank announced this week its mobile farmers market, called the Green Grocer, will be making weekly stops in the parking lot of the former grocery store. Global Links and Greentree unveiled a 10,000-square-foot solar panel this week. It's the first project supported by the Pennsylvania Solar Center, a statewide hub established to help nonprofits and small businesses through the solar purchase process. I'm Maria Scapoletto with the Pittsburgh Business Report on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Times are flush in Pennsylvania, at least according to Democratic Governor Tom Wolf's latest budget proposal. The governor is pitching a $36.1 billion spending plan to the Republican-controlled legislature. That's a 4% increase, or $2 billion more than the budget that was approved for the current year. What does this mean for taxes, education, health, and more? Our team breaks it down, starting with Capitol reporter Katie Meyer.
This is the sixth budget plan Wolf has pitched to the GOP-controlled legislature. Over the years, he's learned not to include the kinds of sweeping tax increases Republicans invariably oppose. This year, he says, the spending increases and program expansions are based on Pennsylvania's healthy revenues.
Today, I present to you a budget that reflects a renewed sense of confidence in Pennsylvania's future.
Republicans didn't contest the rosy revenue projections, but Senate GOP Appropriations Chair Pat Brown cautioned Wolf against overspending, recalling what happened during previous budget impasses.
If we see another downturn, we're back at it again. You know, if we learned anything from the last 10 years, it might be a good idea to shore things up.
Other Republicans, like House Appropriations Chair Stan Saylor, were more blunt in their disapproval.
This budget is long on aspirations and short on details.
Wolf's proposal also includes ideas he's attempted, unsuccessfully, many times before. One is a minimum wage increase from the current $7.25 an hour to $15.
Nobody outworks the people of Pennsylvania. They deserve the same fair wage. Let's make 2020 the year we're going to get them that raise.
Wolf is also bringing back proposals to charge municipalities for state police coverage and overhaul the Commonwealth's corporate tax structure. Republicans say they're not necessarily opposed to many of Wolf's ideas, but that they need to take a hard look at the entire plan. One piece that'll be getting lots of scrutiny, Wolf's call for a $1.2 billion increase to the Department of Health and Human Services. For more on that, reporter Brett Schultes.
Wolf is calling for a huge increase to the Health and Human Services budget to make up for growing costs and cuts to federal programs. It includes proposals to help vulnerable groups such as older Pennsylvanians and people with intellectual disabilities. But Republican House Appropriations Chair Stan Saylor says DHS already has overshot estimates for this year and is spending too much.
Supplemental numbers this year that have been submitted by him for requests for this fiscal year are way too high. And we need to find a way to get that spending under control.
Several initiatives are at stake. The governor wants a funding boost to help people with intellectual disabilities who are on wait lists to receive services. Republican State Representative Tom Mert says that line item is very important.
Most line items in human services have been underfunded for decades. We have never, to this day, taken care of our adults with special needs as we should. There should be no waiting lists at all.
Another initiative would help senior citizens who are also on wait lists to receive home-based services. And Wolf wants to hire dozens more agency staffers to license and regulate many of those programs. Now for a look at education, Keystone Crossroads, Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
In his previous budget addresses, Wolf never even mentioned the words charter schools. That changed in a major way on Tuesday. At one point, Wolf called some charter schools
a little more than fronts for private management companies.
And he added,
our charter school system is in desperate need of reform. It's time to close the loopholes, it's time to establish real standards, and it's time to level the playing field.
By that, Wolf means changing the way cyber charter schools are funded and reducing the amount of money charters receive for special education students. Wolf says the current system inflates cost and that his proposal will save local school districts hundreds of millions of dollars. Charter school backers are furious. They believe this is just a way to appease those who are mad about the popularity of charter schools, which are publicly funded and independently operated. But Republican leadership didn't sound totally turned off by Wolf's proposal. Senate Majority Leader Jake Corman.
We will continue to work, as we have for the last couple years, with them on charter school reform. We think that's a very important issue.
For 20 years, there's been legislative buzz about changing Pennsylvania's charter school law. In the past, though, it's been a political lightning rod. Is this finally the year for compromise? Now for more on another politically sensitive topic, here's Emily Previty from PA Post.
Pennsylvania is facing a court-ordered mandate to improve election security. On top of that, state lawmakers overhauled the election code last year. Changes include giving voters longer to register and the ability to mail in their ballots without an excuse. But the governor's budget doesn't allocate more money to counties for implementation. Lehigh County Republican Pat Brown heads the Senate Appropriations Committee.
Election security is a matter for us to consider as important. You know, and considering the fact that there's not enough money for that purpose, we'll have to negotiate what is necessary.
Some county elections directors have said they'll need more money to implement the new rules. But Lycoming County Director of Elections Forrest Lehman says the Department of State has done most of the work so far, and there's a better way to ease the burden on counties.
Rather than county election officials go into the legislature with their hat out again, because we just got money for voting equipment. I'm satisfied with that. We don't need to ask the legislature for money if they would just give us changes that didn't increase our costs.
Lehman says lawmakers ushered in mail-in ballots with a statutory change that essentially makes more work for counties. And that could be avoided if they amend the state constitution instead. Pennsylvania counties also recently bought new voting machines to comply with the mandate. They're due to get back more than half their costs from the state. And that is in the budget. I'm Emily Previty at the State Capitol.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Governor Wolf's proposed budget for next fiscal year is about $36 billion, up about 4% from 2020. Republican Brian Cutler is the House Majority Leader. He joins us now to share his take. Representative, welcome back to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me again.
Before we get to spending priorities, a quick reaction to the total expenditures. Does that number seem right?
Well, I certainly think that number is high. When you look at what we passed last year, being closer to $34 billion, having a nearly $2 billion jump is substantial. A large part of that, in excess of $800 million, is specifically due to cost overruns in other departments. So I believe that as a chamber and with our friends in the Senate, we will likely be looking at the management of these different departments that consistently overrun on costs. Because each and every time that you have hundreds of millions of dollars in overages, it really is a management issue. And unfortunately, when that money is spent there, it literally is taking money from other programs.
Now, I believe a lot of that overage, if not all of it, had to do with some health programs and maybe a greater demand than anticipated, though?
Well, when you look at the health programs, there's actually a couple components that I think are important. One, in previous human services codes, we had included language to go towards some data efficiencies and outcomes-based healthcare. While the administration is moving in that direction, there continue to be increased costs associated with the way that they are still delivering some of the other services. Additionally, there was recently a federal inspector general's report that indicated that there was over $40 million in expenditures for what they term never events in the healthcare world. These are events that never should happen. For example, they operate on the wrong patient, or they perform the wrong procedure. Our contracts explicitly say that we are not to pay for those events, but upon review by the federal government, they identified over $40 million worth of spending there. I think that's a great place to start. I think we should enforce those contracts and find out why those charges were allowed to come through. Additionally, building off of the value-based healthcare approach, in other words, paying for results, not just the number of visits, right, we need to increase our cost efficiencies there because that would better align our interests, both monetary and outcomes, with those of the patient. We want patients to get healthier. Healthier patients ultimately utilize less healthcare resources and then ultimately end up costing the taxpayers less.
Representative, in recent years, Republican legislative leaders and the governor have been pretty much in sync about boosting education funding. Wolf wants to give public school districts another $280 million because district leaders say charter schools are siphoning their resources. What's your take?
Well, that's an issue that we had identified and worked on in prior sessions. In fact, we have a package of charter reform bills that had passed the House earlier in the session last year. They're currently in the Senate. Those conversations are ongoing. I think that there are ways to correct some of the issues that have been identified. But unfortunately, there's another good example where the governor had identified some possible cost savings, but then ultimately spent the money anyway. So he's created a false choice of, do you support education funding in one form over the other? I think we should be looking for efficiencies and making sure that every student has a quality opportunity for education.
Do you think that the governor's proposal for $200 million in scholarships for students at our state-owned universities could stem the flow of the loss of students at the state-owned universities, 20% decrease over the last decade?
Well, there certainly has been a huge decrease in the student population, but we also have to recognize that a lot of that is being driven by the demographics of our state. When you look at our state, the fastest growing age demographic are those age 85 and older. I do think that the PASHE, the state system, needs some additional tools so that they can better manage their own existing resources. And I'm not sure that simply handing out additional money will stem that. And like many of the programs that we heard earlier today from the governor, it was a little short on details. He did indicate that it would spend $200 million. It would impact a certain number of students, but we have not yet seen the implementing language, but certainly we'll review it if and when he provides that. And I think that we also have to look at what are the schools providing. And if the students are here and choosing to leave elsewhere, we need to understand why they're choosing to not go to state schools. Is it cost-related or is it programmatic?
House Majority Leader Brian Cutler is our guest on The Confluence. Governors often, if not always, use the budget address to mention other items on their priority list. Governor Wolf again urged you and your colleagues to boost the minimum wage to $12 an hour. That would be effective July 1, and then annual increases to $15 per hour by 2026. Will you support that?
Well, my leadership style has actually been very different here in the House. We bring everything up from the committee level on, and this issue is no different. We literally had conversations with both the administration and the committee chairs yesterday. I'm not sure where they will ultimately land, but the conversation around minimum wage has continued.
The House has yet to take action on the Senate-approved measure that would increase the wage to $9.50 an hour by 2022. Why not? What's holding you back?
Many times, anytime that we deal with an issue, it takes multiple iterations and multiple discussions. This one is no different. I understand that it cleared the Senate very quickly. But the House, having 203 members, finding that sweet spot where you can get 102 members to agree on anything can sometimes be challenging.
The governor wants the state to provide $1 billion in its redevelopment assistance capital program for school districts to pay for repairs to remove lead and asbestos. State funding rebates for other repairs of school buildings are already massively behind. Would this expenditure help? Is it enough? And how important is it to remove the lead and asbestos?
Well, the starting point is I do believe that students should have a safe environment in order to learn. Everybody agrees on that, and that includes lead and asbestos remediation. Unfortunately, his proposal, while it had a price tag to it of $1 billion, you actually raised a concern that has been brought up to me regarding existing PlanCon debts that are also already owed to the school. And I think that that's a very valid concern for those schools that are waiting for those cost reimbursements. So I'm not sure that additional borrowing specific to this area would improve payment in either of those. Furthermore, I think that you also have to take a look at which schools have successfully managed this already, because they're already paying higher taxes for having remediated asbestos, lead, or other safety conditions. And we need to see a list from the governor of how many schools are involved, what he thinks those costs are, because I'm not sure that $1 billion, is that too much? Is that too little? I think we need to talk to the administration, get details about their proposals, what their plan is in order to do that. And to answer the first part of your question is, does it impact PlanCon? I think any time that you inject new programs prior to paying for the old, you risk the potential for overreaching.
For a second straight year, Wolf is proposing a $4.5 billion program to fund new infrastructure and expand rural broadband. The proposal would be paid for with a new tax on natural gas drilling. When we talked a few months ago, you indicated your support for infrastructure improvement, but you weren't necessarily in favor of new revenues to pay for it. Is the majority still opposed to a shale tax, whether it pays for infrastructure or education or another spending priority?
Well, I think that what the big concern is regarding the Marcellus Shale debate and the tax versus the impact fee is what happens to that money and how is it stacked. I'm waiting to see the governor's specific proposals on this newest iteration of Restore as well to see if there have been any changes there, because those communities that get those impact dollars rightly are concerned about what happens. Does that impact their revenue stream? I believe that the administration and the IFO both have indicated that next year the impact fees could potentially start to decrease because of the level of drilling activity has started to tail off. So if that's the case, I'm not sure that it's smart to tie future bond payments to a declining revenue stream.
As majority leader, but as a one of 203 state reps, do you think a shale tax is doable?
Well, I think that right now, because of some of the mechanics, I do not know that if the votes are there or not regarding the proposed shale tax, regardless of what he spent it on.
It's an election year for you and your House colleagues, half the Senate. Do you imagine the budget could involve a lot of wrangling?
I don't know, and I don't necessarily think it has. I think we had a very successful approach to the budget in prior years. In terms of what wrangling does that mean, really our goal continues to be the same. We're going to advance good policy that improves the economic well-being and the educational opportunities of everybody here in the Commonwealth, hopefully put some additional money into the rainy day fund because we need to continue to increase that amount of spending. And then finally, and most importantly, it needs to be done quickly, efficiently, and on time.
Republican Brian Cutler is the House Majority Leader. Thanks for your time.
Yep, no problem.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Quentin Crisp was a wit, author, and TV personality of the 20th century. He was also a gay icon, open about his sexuality back when that was rare. Crisp is less well known today, but one local performer seeks to keep his legacy alive. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll reports on his new stage show.
I, too, struggle with the question, why am I famous?
That's Brian Edward rehearsing for the role of Quentin Crisp, who first spoke those lines in the 1970s.
I prefer to think of myself as notorious. Because people that are famous for a reason. People that are notorious are famous for no reason, or no good reason.
Crisp was indeed famous thanks to his one-man stage show and TV talk show appearances. Like a latter-day Oscar Wilde, he cut a foppish figure. His swooping silver hairdo tinted lavender, topped by his floppy-brimmed black fedora, tilted rakishly. His white pocket handkerchief blossomed like an orchid. Here is Crisp himself around 1980 on stage in Los Angeles.
Never try to keep up with the Joneses. Drag them down to your level. It's cheaper.
Crisp was born near London, England in 1908. He became notorious in the late 60s when he published his autobiography, The Naked Civil Servant. The book detailed his travails growing up effeminate in a country where gay sex was illegal and his years as a professional artist's model. He was a philosopher of sorts who exhorted people to discover and flaunt their individual styles. Crisp again.
Indeed, we might say that the whole purpose of existence is to try to reconcile the glowing opinion we have of ourselves with the terrible things that other people say about us.
Naked Civil Servant was adapted for British TV. Later, Crisp, by then in his 70s, moved to New York City. He wrote more than a dozen books. For some, his message was a lifeline.
As a young man, a young teenager in the hills of eastern Kentucky in the early 1970s, it was a pretty frightful time to be a gay person.
Philip Ward remembers watching Naked Civil Servant.
To see this man on television in 1975 provided encouragement for one to be oneself at all costs.
A decade later in New York, Ward befriended Crisp and then became his personal assistant. After Crisp died in 1999, Ward was appointed executor of his estate. Then 2 years ago, after posthumous publication of Crisp's autobiography, The Last Word, Ward got an email from a Pittsburgh-based writer and actor.
What impressed him was my knowledge and respect for the Crisp legacy, and the fact that I'm 38, and that as he sees it, it's my generation now that's going to carry on that legacy.
Brian Edward was also a teenager when he discovered Crisp in the 1990s. The effect was similar to what Ward had found two decades earlier.
It was just, okay, well, this is how to live. This is the path of it, because, you know, it brought a lot of joy.
Edward and Ward edited Crisp's solo show and his book The Last Word into a two-act monologue. While other stage shows have celebrated Crisp, this is the first approved by his estate and consisting entirely of Crisp's own words. Crisp was not always in step with the times. He disdained politics and protest movements. And he sometimes criticized the American gay community as too conformist or desirous to appease mainstream society. But there was another way in which Crisp was ahead of his time, says Edward. The moment came very late in Crisp's life.
He confesses that he wishes that he would have been born a woman. Here in 1999 is a man 90 years old, and for him to make peace with that, really, mere months before he died, is an incredible thing.
Crisp remains inspiring for many.
I think we can always go back to people like Quentin Crisp, people who just accept their gifts and use them.
Tim Haggerty is a professor at Carnegie Mellon University and co-director of the Pittsburgh Queer History Project.
For lack of a better term, it's the politics of being fabulous.
Or as Crisp, as portrayed by Brian Edward, puts it,
being on the stage is exactly the same for me as being anywhere else.
The Last Word is staged in City Theater's intimate Hamburg Studio Theater on the South Side. There are 8 performances starting Thursday. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, Bookish in the Burg, a teen literary festival, is beginning its second year. We'll talk with founder and director Kelsey Ford about her efforts to celebrate teen literature while encouraging lifelong reading. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. We had production assistance from Caldwell Holden and Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.